Greetings, warriors, veterans, and American-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Hoo-wah! The Frontlines of Freedom team really appreciate you joining us this fine day in America. We are proud Americans. Hey, troops, if you like coffee, and who doesn't, you want to try Freedom One Coffee. It's run by an active-duty couple who love our nation and coffee. Everything, even the packaging, is amazing. Check freedom1coffee.com. Here's what we have for you this hour. We're going to start by talking with Army vet Shad Meshed. He's the founder and president of the National Veterans Foundation. After receiving his master's degree in psychiatric social work, he enlisted in the Army in 1970, served as a counselor to our soldiers in Vietnam. For over 50 years, he's worked as a therapist for veterans and an advocate for veterans' rights. Gotta love this guy. Welcome to the show, Shad.
Hey, Dennis, it's a pleasure. Airborne all the way.
Hoo-ah. Yes, sir. Shad, start by telling us about your time in the Army. Why did you join and what did you do? We talked about some counseling, but talk about it specifically.
Well, my father and his brother, father was in Army Air Force and my uncle was in the Marines. They both served. I mean, it's just something back in the 40s and 50s that at least Southerners did. It was an honor, you know, to serve. So I went into ROTC. I was in the Loyola University program. I was based in Spring Hill College in Mobile, and I decided, what the heck, I'll go through ROTC. It was offered. I only had to march around one day a week or whatever, and basically got through all of that. Did my basic in 65 at Fort Bragg, the 82nd Airborne. Less than a year later, I was commissioned a second lieutenant in the infantry. At the same time, as I was graduating and getting commissioned as a second lieutenant, I got a fellowship to grad school. And 3% of my class in that year nationwide in ROTC got deferments for grad school. And it was just a god shot. I got a deferment, went to Florida State. I had 36 months to complete, had to keep a B-plus average. And from 66 to 69, I was a student in reserves as infantry. As I graduated, Dennis, the military probably been planning for years to create psychiatric mental health teams in war. You've heard all the terms over the last century, from soldier's heart to combat stress and shell shock or whatever, but they had decided to address it. And I was one of the first of 15 officers that went to war. And I was one of those that went in 70 after I went from infantry to Medical Service Corps. I had to go to branch school. I went to Fort Sam Houston, got through the medical training and everything, and then was assigned to Vietnam in 1970. And there was no book for that. There was a book for infantry and jungle training or whatever, but we went over there and sort of winged it by our pants. I'm one of the authors on the war. I had to write about that experience because it was a cross between a Catch-22 and a MASH film. But I was all over primarily 1 and 2 Corps. I got appointed by the commanding officer, Colonel Banks, to be, he needed a human service officer. It's probably quite different than your tours, Dennis. You know, we had all kinds of different problems by 70, 2 years after Tet. There was racial problems, drug problems, fragging problems. I mean, it was helter skelter pretty much for us dealing with these problems. And I'd see 40 or 50 troops that would be sent down to the MASH hospital. And the first one I was in Da Nang, the 95th Evac. And we'd see everything, but we really didn't have any clout because the commanding officers that sent troops with problems, mostly 18, 19-year-olds, wanted them back. So it was kind of hard to do any sort of therapy or counseling in 50 minutes and make a decision whether this person, let's say was gone psychotic because of war, needed to be evacuated to Japan, or was just having a problem in both, usually, with our recommendations, went back to their unit because we had no power over that. You know, it was just basically this individual needs 30 days off or needs to be reassigned or whatever. So I saw everything. I wrote about it years ago. And Vietnam, it really changed my life. There wasn't much psychiatry that you could really do given the circumstances. But I really enjoyed the position of being the human service officer for 1 and 2 Corps, where I flew in to MASH hospitals and other units, like the 173rd 4th Infantry Division, the 1st Mechanized Infantry on the Z, and all the Marine units all over I Corps. And that part was sensational because I was flying at 5 a.m. up to different parts of the other, you know, 1 and 2 zones of Vietnam. And then in the last 3 months of my tour, I got reassigned to 3 Corps in Long Bend and continued to do the same work there until I got that Christmas drop from Nixon. Supposed to get out a week before, but that's another story because we couldn't get airplanes in to give us our drop. I think I got a week out of the 3-week drop we were supposed to get, but it changed my life. I'm sure it did yours, Dennis. You were in a different capacity, but I got to fly in and out of those and do my best to help the grunts and everybody else out.
Hey, you are breaking ground. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're discussing the National Veterans Foundation. Well, we're not there. We're getting to the National Veterans Foundation with Shad Meshed. Well, you know, the whole concept of military hospitals from the very beginning was to get soldiers back into battle.
Right.
And therefore, we were still in that mode. So you were really breaking new ground, weren't you?
Yeah, we were. We were doing our best, too. A lot of it ended up being Band-Aid therapy because we had really no authority. We had a mission to evaluate and assess and recommend. But the recommendations most of the time, particularly with someone with emotional issues, let's put it that way, if they were physically fit, the commanders wanted them back in the unit. And so a lot of terrible things happened because they made those kind of decisions with people that ended up in some cases fragging the commanders because of the fact that for whatever reasons they couldn't handle being a warfighter. And a lot of it had to do that how the energy and the morale of the war in 70 on had changed, particularly after Tet. And, you know, TV was covering it or whatever. It was a lot of pressure. And so it really affected the morality. It affected the racial issues or whatever as I look back 50 plus years.
Well, obviously, all this led you to creating the National Veterans Foundation. And that's what we're going to talk about in the next segment. But that's got to be the background for it. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely, Dennis. Absolutely.
Because when you see the pain and the need, how can you not be touched by it and want to do something about it, particularly when you see that the system, for good reasons or not good reasons, whatever, isn't dealing with it in at least some instances. For some people, just going back to work is the right answer. But there are others where it's not. And that has to be the way it goes. Well, there's more to discuss about supporting veterans, and Shad's going to stay with us. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. It's time to run hard for a couple of miles, troops. Do this while thinking patriotic thoughts. I'll be right back.
This is Lieutenant Colonel Retired John Barry, managing partner of Barry Law. For over 50 years, Barry Law has defended the rights of Americans, both on the battlefield and in the courtroom. We are committed to supporting our fellow service members. If you need help appealing your VA disability decision, find us at PTSDlawyers.com or call 888-883-2483.
Fellow Americans, we need your help. PatriotFoods.com, we are fighting for the American farmer. U.S. only fruits and vegetables from your soil. Go to PatriotFoods.com, use your promo code FREEDOM, and you get 10% off today. Support your U.S. farmer. Promo code FREEDOM, 10% off. Thank you so much.
It's great food. I eat it. This is Colonel Danny Gillum. PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Thanks for joining us today on Frontlines of Freedom. We're continuing our conversation with Shad Meshack, president of the National Veterans Foundation, about how the foundation helps veterans and their families. Let's go there, Shad.
Well, first of all, when I got back from Vietnam, I realized that, particularly at the time I was there, that these 18, 19-year-old, 20-year-olds were really going to have a severe readjustment issue because the country was split. We were already being called baby killers, dope addicts, whatever. And America confused us with the war. So I had the opportunity to assess the largest psychiatric VA hospital in the country. And it was in Los Angeles. There were 335 Vietnam era veterans in the county. And very few were even using the VA or going to the VA. And because of my position in Vietnam, I was asked to assess it summer of 71. And what I saw was the fact that I understood why I wouldn't go to the VA, and I would do a whole show on that. But the director wanted me to create something that would get the VA connected with these combat vets. So I hit the streets of LA and eventually set up my own unit called the Vietnam Veterans Resocialization Unit. And because of 6 or 7 years on the streets and a lot of media recognition, because I was one of the few mental health people working directly just with Vietnam vets all over the city with the largest population, I got attention. I got pulled into Washington under Senator Alan Cranston, a World War II vet, head of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, and wanted to know who this madman, which was my nickname, Shad Meshad, his funny name and this Southern accent, what he's doing there. And he had been pushing in the early 70s, a readjustment act, because he was aware that Vietnam vets were coming back with a lot of reintegration problems. And I had been doing it in Los Angeles. So when I spent 2 years flying into DC and explaining my unit in Los Angeles, he decided that this was the program that he wanted nationwide. And it was Public Law 9622. The Vietnam Vet Psychological Readjustment Program, Public Law 9622, that we finally pushed through Congress, and the rest is history. I was rolling for the next 7 years, setting up the first 100 vet centers in America, from Puerto Rico, Alaska, Hawaii, you name it, and all the major cities in between. And it was insane because, you know, it was like, you got to do this now, and trying to hire 300 or 400 vets that could work and deal with what we now know as PTSD. Many of us had PTSD, so it wasn't really a good match, as I found out after the first 2 years. But anyway, we sort of got that ironed out, got tired of the bureaucracy, wanted to set up something simple, stupid, which is what I thought after that time, 17 years on the streets, what veterans really needed. They needed a voice, and they needed to be able to call a number, call a vet and ask anything, not VA questions. I didn't, from employment to where they are they flipping out or whatever. And I set up the National Veterans Foundation, which was the spinoff, which was, it wasn't the end all be all, but it was the first conversation that veterans coming out of the war, particularly to today, they call a number where you're talking to a vet that says, all right, what's going on? What do you need? It's like peer to peer counseling, but with trained people. And that's really what I saw missing into the VA and the vet center programs, is people needed to be able to call anytime and say, hey, I'm depressed. I got a gun. What's going on? You go, hey, just like you and I, Dennis, talking, hey, you eventually ended up in denying you were 82nd. You were a big red one. You know, that's the language we talk even after the war. And those are powerful conversations. And nobody was listening. Nobody wanted to know, particularly during Vietnam and after, you know, what your experience was. You know, hey, you're going to get a job. You're going to go here. You're going to go there. Just total chaos. And the first program, the Vet Center program, is still there. There's over 300 centers. But I wanted a program they could call. And if they needed a vet center, I would tell them about the vet center and where to go. If they needed the VA, I'd help them navigate the bureaucracy because I've been through it. And all my team are all veterans. So we know the system, but the system's not going to tell them how to integrate or how to move through their bureaucracy. And we've been doing it 36 years. In addition to doing homeless outreach here in the city with the largest veteran homeless population in America. And that's another problem that we've tried to address, but it's mammoth. It's just like the virus program, the COVID epidemic that we have, you know, are we really addressing it? You know, some do, some don't.
Okay, Shad, this is awesome. It's speaking to real problems and trying to provide real solutions that the patient thinks is real.
Exactly.
Forget the science. Let's help the guy who's hurting. This is Colonel Denny Gilliam on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Shad Meshad. Shad, we've only got a couple of minutes left. Sum up the two or three key points you want everybody to take from our conversation today.
First of all, the National Veterans Foundation, our information and crisis hotline, going into its 37th year, we've treated over 475,000 veterans or families and children from all wars. And we're open 9 to 5 Pacific Standard Time every day, Monday through Friday. Can always leave a message here. If you want to check us out, go on to the website and look up www.nvf.org. Navy, Foxtrot, Victory, whatever you want to .org. And it's for all veterans and families or whatever. And you'll get a live vet. If it's after hours, leave a message, leave your number. We will get back to you. Our whole mission is to get you started on now and in the future, where you need to go and the roadblocks that you face. Majority of our calls now because our OEF, OIF vets from all branches, and particularly after the end of the Afghan conflict, it just ended suddenly. Our suicide rate has gone up or whatever. We do suicide ideation counseling, but we talk to you direct. It's like talking to you, Dennis. It's just, we got your back. Just stay with us. We're here. You can call anytime. It's free. We'll get you to where you need to go 90% of the time.
How do they reach you and who do you help? And is this true across the whole nation?
It's a nationwide program. We're a national nonprofit. They call the toll-free number 888-777-4443. It's 888-777-4443 between 9 and 5 Pacific Standard Time. And a veteran will answer the phone and we'll start wherever you are.
You know, it doesn't get any better than that because that's who we veterans need. We need to talk to a veteran and somebody who has a mind to help us get help. That's
what it's all about.
And by the way, the National Veterans Foundation is a nonprofit. You accept donations too, right?
Yes. You can go online at nvf.org and you make a donation, support us. We have a chat line. We have a dedication. We get a lot of our donations from people in honor of a father, a mother, a brother who passed away. We do everything we can in that power because it takes everything. And we just can't wait for politicians or whatever to get it. I've been to Congress so many times testifying on these needs or whatever. And they listen, but they pat you on the back. But that's, you know, I'm back to the streets. This is where it's at. It's where I'm comfortable. 51 years in this county.
Hey, brother, I appreciate you.
Dennis, I appreciate you for letting us get the word out. That's what it's about.
Thank you, Shad. Thanks for taking the time to join us today. But thank you for your service to our nation in uniform. And double thanks for what you're doing now. I'm proud to call you brother.
Simplify, bro.
Coming up next on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll talk with General Chris Petty about the Battle of the Month. Then we'll open our weekly mailbag. This is Colonel Denny Gilliam on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for one-arm push-ups. Just do a dozen with each arm twice. Then take a break, but stay in the area. I'll be right back.
From ending our nation's endless wars to making sure veterans get the care they deserve to addressing our country's out-of-control spending problem, Concerned Veterans for America is taking on the most important issues facing our nation. You can help CVA shape a better future for Americans everywhere. Visit cv4a.org to learn more, see how you can get involved, and join our movement. That's cv4a.org.
Day 3 Creation is a Christian family-owned provider of American-made, non-intoxicating, non-addictive CBD products. Our Get Relief, Give Relief program sees that 10% of all profits go to Patriot Paws, providing service dogs at no cost to disabled veterans to help restore their physical and emotional independence. Giving is an expression of our thankfulness and praise to God as we recognize that everything we have belongs to the Lord. Visit day3creation.com to learn more. God bless. Welcome back to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Troops, I really do welcome your comments and questions. Contact me through frontlinesoffreedom.com or on Facebook. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show retired Army General Chris Petty. As you know from the last time he joined us on the show, he's big into military history. So Chris and I conspired, and we've decided that we're going to be on the show each month to discuss the battle of the month. And this is the kickoff for that plan. So welcome to my co-conspirator, General Chris Petty. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Denny. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Chris, start with a quick review of your Army career.
Okay, I'll give you the real quick rundown. West Point, graduated 1987, active duty Army aviator, kind of by background, did the normal progressive assignments, active duty. Then I joined the Guard after the Cold War was over. It looked like a pretty boring future in the military. Started business, but missed it. So joined the Guard, company commander, battalion commander. Actually took a battalion to Iraq during the height of the war, during the surge. The unit did really outstanding, remarkable things, which, you know, which advanced my career, actually. And then I, after brigade command, I got to pin on a star and do some interesting assignments more at the, you know, the operational strategic level of the Army, including the Pentagon, where I worked on the Army staff. I worked in a combatant command with U.S. NORTHCOM, and I was a commander of the NATO headquarters in Bosnia. So I got to see a lot of the military, how it works, how it thinks, how it makes decisions. And also I got the honor of leading troops in combat. So it was a really incredibly fulfilling and satisfying career. Thanks.
Hey, amen, brother. We're going to talk about the Battle of the Month, but Chris, I think our motivation for doing the Battle of the Month is something we need to share as we start. Give us your perspective on that.
Well, Denny, as you and I talked about this, I think it's important to understand American history, and I think the battles that we cover in a really brief format and kind of an executive overview, I guess you could say, because, you know, we don't have time to go into all the detail and people don't need to know all the detail, but I think one of the big benefits of trying to do this for your audience is, you know, these are touch points for a common cultural history and what it means to be an American. So like today, we're going to talk about Bunker Hill. And again, we can't get into all the detail and the exciting, you know, back and forth of Bunker Hill, but we can give you an appreciation of what happened on that day and understanding the place that this battle holds in American history and how it helped form this nation. So just creating some common cultural heritage, I think, through key battles, and I mean key battles, we're not talking about unknown battles and trivia. We're talking about Bunker Hill today. I mean, that's the battle that really kind of cemented the beginning of the American Revolution and created change on both sides. So we're just going to try to create some of those common cultural touch points in what is a very divided society today. These common themes can bring us together, actually.
Yes, sir. And as you said, our Battle of the Month is the Battle of Bunker Hill. Take us there.
Okay, so Bunker Hill, everyone's familiar with the idea. Everyone kind of knows some things about it. This famous battle on 17 June of 1775. So first, let me tell you why it's important to history. It really was the first battle of the American Revolution. You can count Lexington Concord, but that was really a skirmish, a series of skirmishes and a British retreat where they were fired on, sort of ambushes. But this Bunker Hill is really the first battle. And what it did for the colonies, it really kind of set the course for the revolution. There was no going back from after Bunker Hill. Too much blood was lost. And it gave the colonies some confidence that, hey, we might be able to stand up to the British. Look what our militias just did to the most fearsome fighting force in the world at the time. It also gave the British some pause on, wow, this may not be as easy as we thought, because this was a bloody day and the rebels held their lines pretty effectively. And as we said earlier, I mean, this is one of those key battles in American history that charted our course. So it's important to understand it. So that's kind of the why it's important. So I'll set the stage of the battle so we can kind of walk through it real quick. To the British, Massachusetts was kind of spiraling out of control in spring and summer of 1775. And you all know some of that history. They sent a large force to seize weapons at Concord. And this happened 2 months before Bunker Hill. So General Gage, who was the commander of the American colonies for the British, was worried about the rebellion building in Massachusetts, at the surrounding area of Boston. And you all know what happened at Lexington Concord. I mean, that turned into a very embarrassing and bloody retreat for the British after they tried to seize weapons at the Concord Armory. And after that, the colonies started sending militias around Boston to really create effectively a siege of Boston, because the colonies were all excited. The New England colonies, in this case, were all excited about what was happening and the, I guess, in quotes, maybe you could say the victory of Lexington Concord had everyone's dander up. And so militias were flowing into Boston. And pretty soon, General Gage found himself surrounded and basically hemmed in. It was effectively a siege. So he's trying to figure out how to break out of Boston, surrounded by militias, and regain some freedom of maneuver, because he can't just be trapped in Boston. So he hatches a plan to occupy the high ground south of Boston, and that would let him start clearing territory to the north. Now, that's the British perspective. Now, the colonials, they're pretty confident after Lexington Concord. Militias and volunteers really converged effectively on the city. Dr. Joseph Warren, who you've heard as a historical figure, he's the president of the Massachusetts Committee of Safety. And in colonial times, revolutionary times, these committees of safety were essentially de facto governments, because the British governments were not acceptable to the revolutionary folks of the time. And his senior commander, General Artemas Ward, was the senior Massachusetts officer, and he was trying to cobble together a unified force out of all these disparate militias showing up. But the Committee of Safety learned that through spies, because they had a very extensive spy network, as you can imagine, in Boston, they learned of Gage's plan, and they decided they were going to preempt it by fortifying Bunker Hill, which really, if you can visualize Boston, the Charlestown Peninsula is directly north and slightly west of Boston, and it's got high ground on it, Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill. So they were going to fortify Bunker Hill to kind of preempt Gage's plan. And so Ward directed Colonel William Prescott to lead the mission. And on the evening of 16 June, he assembled 1,000 men in Cambridge and moved out to the peninsula. And they were joined along the way by 200 men of New Hampshire, led by Captain Knowlton. And it was close to midnight on the 16th when they laid out their spot on Breed's Hill, as opposed to Bunker Hill. And there's a lot of debate on why the decision was made. And it's actually not that clear why they picked Breed's Hill. But regardless, it's
that's where they were. That's what they picked. This is
yeah, that's what they picked. That's what they picked. So the Battle of Bunker Hill is misnamed. It was really Breed's Hill.
This is Colonel Denny Gilliam in Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Chris Petty about the battle of the month, the Battle of Bunker Hill. Okay, Chris. Everybody's lining up. How'd it go?
Okay, so the stage was set as they dug in to start building their redoubt. So the battle itself is a remarkable story. Before we get into the details, it's kind of that David versus Goliath militia, unprofessional militia, part-time versus British regulars. It's a story of grit, determination, bravery of the colonial militia, and adaptability, as I'll try to point out a couple of things. It's also a story of British miscalculation. So here's how it played out. So the men dug in through the night. By dawn, they had an impressive redoubt, 6-foot walls, dry moat, pretty defensible space. And as the sun came up, a British ship saw them and started firing on the earthworks. And they were fired on all day. But the men kept improving the position throughout the fire. So Gates, back in Boston, is putting together his hasty attack plan. He moves troops from Boston to Peninsula And his plan is to flank the rebel left, collapse the line, and by 1 o'clock in the afternoon, his troops are landing on the peninsula. But the colonials are busy. You know, they're working on taking care of their vulnerable spots. They see that they're very vulnerable on the left, on their north flank, fortify a rail fence that runs towards the water. And a famous guy named Colonel John Stark puts his men behind the fence. That becomes a key defensive line. And Stark makes another key discovery is there's a beach on the north of the peninsula that's wide open. So he builds a hasty stone wall, puts his best men behind it. So General Gage sent General Howe as his, you know, his ranking subordinate was in charge of the operation, General William Howe. And he landed and he saw the rebels had improved their works quite a bit. So he sent back for his reserves, which gave the rebels a little more time to improve their position. And he doesn't attack till 3 o'clock, which is important because, again, they have lots of time to improve. He sends his light infantry along the beach because his plan was to outflank the position and against his main force going against the rail fence and the redoubt. And his light infantry, as they're moving up the beach, it seems like everything's going to be pretty easy and they're going to accomplish what they set out to do. But just as they formed for their bayonet charge, Stark's men pop up from behind the stone wall and kill 100 of this elite light infantry scrambling along the beach in 3 volleys of fire. So that's kind of the first bloody nose of the battle.
And the problem for the British is they underestimated the Americans. And the only problem the Americans had is we ran out of ammunition. And ultimately, the British drove us off. But it was really a wonderful victory and sort of set the stage for the future fights, didn't it?
Yeah, it really did. It really did. And in the battle itself, General Howe, he ends up doing 3 waves, 3 different assaults. His first 2 are repulsed and shocking for him that these untrained rebels are standing up to his elite infantry and grenadiers. But by the 3rd assault, you got to give Gage a little bit of credit. I mean, he's stubborn and he's very determined, but he does make some critical adjustments. And he attacks in column rather than line. He has his men take off their heavy packs because it's a hot June day, so they can have more mobility coming up the hill. And he brings his artillery because he finally gets the right ammo for his artillery. And so that starts to take a toll. But you're right. I mean, in the end, the men are running out of ammunition. They're standing the ground to the end and using their muskets as clubs and as the British start pouring over the walls. So, and then they retreat across the peninsula and Howe doesn't want to pursue because he's lost so much that day. So it's a very costly victory for the British and a confidence builder for the colonials.
It was indeed. And brother, we're out of time.
Wow.
So this is our first battle of the month. We'll be doing one every month. Chris, thank you. Thank you for taking time to join us today. Thank you for joining our team as a monthly contributor. Oh, quick. You've got a publication you put out regularly with military history on it. What is it and how can people touch it?
Yes, thanks, Denny. Just go to battledigest.com. One word, battledigest.com. I publish these summaries. They're short, sweet, graphically appealing, and your listeners will love them.
Indeed. Thank you, Chris. Until next month. Thanks, brother.
Thanks, Denny.
Troops, if you're a veteran who's having trouble getting your disability approved by the VA, contact Barry Law. Reach them at ptsdlawyers.com. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Next up, it's time for our weekly mailbag. Then it's military history time. You've reported for duty to Frontlines of Freedom. Stand tall, troops. Do some more push-ups. How about 60 this time? I want your ranger ready. Then stand at ease. Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code.
HelpVet.net is here to help all veterans, active military, and families. HelpVet.net is a national help center helping the military community with their everyday needs. Whether you need a realtor, an attorney, discounted services, or information on retirement benefits, financial resources, and much more, our vast network of hand-picked qualified service providers are waiting to help you. With up-to-date military news and resources, you can find answers to all your needs at HelpVet.net. HelpVet.net. Never forget, never forgotten.
Do you have a story inside you yearning to come out? As a self-published author, you are free to creatively distribute your book online or using your own professional connections. White Feather Press will publish your manuscript and set up online distribution, allowing the author to retain all copyright and distribution rights as well as all profits. Check out White Feather Press at publishyourdream.com. White Feather Press, reaffirming faith in God, family, and country. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. This is the final formation for this week on Frontlines of Freedom. Okay, team, it's mailbag time. I welcome comments from you, our listeners. Do send your thoughts to me at danny@frontlinesoffreedom.com or on Facebook. Skip, what's the first comment?
Well, Pete, an Army dad thought that the comments by the general on racism and radicalism in the Army were exaggerations until he talked with his son and found out they were true. This is horrible.
Pete, you're right. Our military needs to get back on being focused on being combat ready.
An Air Force vet, Sue, a longtime listener, really enjoyed the review on the founding of the show. Good job, guys.
Thanks, Sue. It's been fun. And now it's time for military history. Take us there, Skip. What's first?
Well, Colonel, on June 22, 1807, British officers of the HMS Leopard boarded the USS Chesapeake after she had set sail for the Mediterranean and demanded the right to search the ship for deserters. Commodore James Barron refused, and the British opened fire with broadsides on the unprepared Chesapeake and forced her to surrender. The British provocation led to the War of 1812.
Not too surprised. Okay, on 22 June 1876, General Alfred Terry sent Lieutenant Colonel George Custer to the Rosebud and Little Bighorn Rivers in search of Indian villages. That didn't have a good outcome.
No, that did not work well for George, did it? And on 20 June 1898, during the Spanish-American War, while on the way to the Philippines to fight the Spanish, the U.S. Navy cruiser Charleston seized the island of Guam.
Which was a Spanish island. Okay, on 22 June 1898, during the Spanish-American War, Admiral Sampson began an amphibious landing near Santiago, Cuba. Lieutenant Colonel Theodore Roosevelt and Colonel Leonard Wood led the Rough Riders, a volunteer cavalry regiment, onto the beach at Dalcree.
And on 22 June 1936, Congress passed an act to define jurisdiction of Coast Guard. In one of the most sweeping grants of police authority ever written into U.S. law, Congress designated the Coast Guard as the federal agency for enforcement of laws generally on the high seas and navigable waters of the United States.
And on 22 June 1941, during World War II, Operation Barbarossa, the German attack on the Soviet Union, began. Despite the massive preparation spent over many months and the numerous indications Stalin received from many sources, the Soviet forces were taken almost completely by surprise and lost very heavily at first. The Germans had almost 140 divisions. On the first day, almost everything went the German way. The attack began at 3 a.m. with ground attacks and simultaneous airstrikes. The Luftwaffe was over Soviet bases exactly at 0 hour. By noon, the Soviets had lost about 1,200 planes. The land battle was equally successful. The Panzer Spearhead Army Group North advanced 40 miles during the day, and Army Group Center captured most of the Bug River bridges intact.
And on June 22, 1944, President Franklin Roosevelt signed the GI Bill, an unprecedented act of legislation designed to compensate returning members of the armed services for their efforts in World War II. The GI Bill was officially the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944. The American Legion successfully fought for many of the provisions, which gave returning servicemen access to unemployment compensation, low-interest home and business loans, and most importantly, funding for education. By giving veterans money for tuition, living expenses, books, and supplies, the GI Bill effectively transformed higher education in America. Before the war, college had been an option for only 10 to 15% of young Americans, and university campuses were a haven for the wealthy classes. By 1947, in contrast, vets made up half of the nation's college enrollment. 3 years later, nearly 500,000 Americans graduated from college, compared with 160,000 in 1939.
That sounds good. And on 20 June 1948, President Harry Truman instituted a military draft, calling up for nearly 10 million men to register for military service within the next 2 months. Truman's action came during the increasing Cold War tensions with the Soviet Union. Following World War II, which ended in 45, we quickly demobilized our vast military. During the war, over 16 million men and women served in the military. But when the war ended in August of 45, we demobilized. By 1948, less than 550,000 men remained in our army. This reduction in the size of our military concerned our leaders, who believed that a confrontation with the Soviet Union was imminent. Following World War II, our relations with the Russians deteriorated rapidly. In 1947, President Truman issued the Truman Doctrine, which provided aid to Greece and Turkey to oppose communist subversion. Secretary of State George Marshall warned that Western Europe was on the brink of political and economic chaos and would leave it defenseless against communist aggression. And Congress approved billions of dollars in financial assistance to the beleaguered nations. Then it got worse.
And on June 24, 1948, one of the most dramatic standoffs in the history of the Cold War began as the Soviet Union blocked all road and rail traffic to and from West Berlin. The blockade turned out to be a terrible diplomatic move by the Soviets, while the U.S. emerged from the confrontation with renewed purpose and confidence. For a few tense days, the world waited to see whether the U.S. and Soviet Union would come to blows. In West Berlin, panic began to set in as its people worried about shortages of food, water, and medical aid. Our response came just 2 days after the Soviets began their blockade. A massive airlift of supplies into West Berlin was undertaken in what was to become one of the greatest logistical efforts in history. Russia looked like an international bully that was trying to starve men, women, and children into submission. On May 12, 1949, the Soviets officially ended the blockade.
And on 21 June 1966, U.S. planes struck North Vietnamese petroleum storage facilities in a series of devastating raids. These missions were part of Operation Rolling Thunder, which had been launched in March 1965 after President Lyndon Johnson ordered a sustained bombing campaign of North Vietnam. The goal was to interdict North Vietnamese transportation routes to the southern part of North Vietnam and to slow infiltration of personnel and supplies into South Vietnam. The White House closely controlled Operation Rolling Thunder, and at times, President Johnson personally selected targets. From 1965 to 1968, about 643,000 tons of bombs were dropped on North Vietnam. And that's military history for today. And now it's time for our self-defense report. Take us there, Skip.
All of us here at Frontlines of Freedom want our listeners to get trained and get armed in that order. We fully support the right to keep and bear arms for all law-abiding families. And we encourage you to find out about the laws governing use of deadly force in your state and follow them to the letter. And of course, don't forget to follow the rules of safety and common sense whenever you're carrying a firearm to protect the ones you love. What's the story this week, Colonel?
Well, a Detroit homeowner, Massio Jackson, woke up around 4:30 a.m. on Tuesday to a man pounding on his door. According to Jackson, the man was talking about someone owed him money. "I said, no one here owes you money. I don't know what you're talking about." When the man refused to leave, Jackson called the police. And that's when the situation escalated. The man broke a window in an attempt to enter the property. A doorbell camera captured the armed man standing outside Jackson's door. "Quote, I came outside and said, you have to leave. You can't be doing this," Jackson told the media. "So when he reached for his gun and pulled it out, I had to defend myself. I had to shoot him because of that." Jackson fired four shots at the man, hitting him in the chest and killing him.
Thanks, Colonel. This Detroit homeowner did a great job defending himself, and Frontlines of Freedom commends him. But let's go over some things he did right and also some things that can be improved on. We're not criticizing, just learning by his experience so you and I can do an even better job of protecting our lives and the ones we love. First, what did he do right? Well, he talked to the man through the door and tried to reason with him. In self-defense circles, we call that verbal judo. It doesn't always work, but sometimes you can talk sense into someone who's acting stupid. And if you can safely do this from behind cover, then it's a good idea to try. Simply because if you talk them out of committing a crime, then you won't have to shoot them. And second, the homeowner had the presence of mind to get his gun before dealing with the threat. Many people fall apart when under stress, but Masso did not. He kept his head and he remembered to get his gun just in case he couldn't talk the man down. Third, when the time came to draw his gun to defend himself, the homeowner did not hesitate. He knew it was legal to defend himself and he did what he had to do to survive. Many people aren't sure when it's legal to shoot, so they hold back, and that hesitation can get you killed. Fourth, he was a good marksman. He made four shots center mass and stopped the threat. Shooting in a high-stress situation isn't easy, but Mazza was able to draw, aim, and make good shots. Obviously, this homeowner did a lot of good things, and he prevailed. You don't have to do everything perfect to survive. The only thing I see Mazo could have done better was this. When someone is trying to break into your home, it's a better idea to wait for them to come into your home rather than go outside to meet them on the lawn. When he exited his home, Mazo lost the legal protection that Castle Doctrine offers and also the physical protection that all the cover inside his home provides. Despite that, this Detroit homeowner did a great job defending his home, and Front Lines of Freedom salutes this Motor City homeowner for a job well done.
Amen. Our movie of the month is Monmouth County 9/11 and its aftermath. You can go to the Front Lines of Freedom website, go to the blog and get the link. You can watch it for free. We'll review it at the end of the month, and I'd really appreciate getting your comments. Please send them to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com. Next week on Front Lines of Freedom, John Byrne from Concerned Veterans for America will return to discuss endless wars and NATO. And Marine General and Congressman Jack Bergman will discuss some of the challenges our nation is facing, and we'll review the movie of the month with Diane Raver. Our book, Front Lines of Freedom, with 19 authors and with the mission of helping all patriotic Americans step up and help our nation return to our traditional values of serving, not being served, of being in shape physically, mentally, and morally, of being proud of our nation. You can purchase that book on frontlinesoffreedom.com. Please help us get this call to action book into the hands of all Americans.
Thank you, friends, for joining us for Front Lines of Freedom today and every week on this great station. Please check us out on Facebook and add your comments. And if you missed any part of this show, hey, all our shows are available on demand at frontlinesoffreedom.com. We especially thank our military listeners for serving our country with honor and dignity and for keeping us all safe. God bless you and your families as you serve.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Thank you, listeners all across America, for joining us in the foxholes on the Front Lines of Freedom. Stand tall, be proud Americans, and join me next week for military and veteran information that you will not get anywhere else on the Front Lines of Freedom. Dismissed.